Welcome to a program called Maximizing New Media Distributions, Windows, Exclusivity, and Global Platforms. My name is Chris Keneally. I am with the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center at copyright.com, and very grateful for the invitation to be here today from Victor Harwood and the Digital Hollywood organization. And we're happy to be here because for Copyright Clearance Center, it's an opportunity to kind of get out of our usual corner of things in the text and book publishing world and learn a bit about the changes going on in video and film. And I was struck particularly by this notion that we are going to be talking about maximizing new media distribution because the question occurs to me, well, what does that mean, new media? How new are we talking about? It's a distinction that is increasingly meaningless in the world that you all live in. But the people we have on our panel today have a perspective on it. I don't think they want us to talk about it as new media.
We're old.
And old media. You beat me to it, Rob. But I think that I would say that it is a more complete picture, that new media is only a piece of a pie and not the pie itself. And what they can tell us about is an approach to doing business, one that does the things that we're talking about, maximize distribution revenues, because it incorporates the two mentalities that are at play here. There's the mentality to think like a studio, and there's the mentality to think like a YouTube star. And again, the differences are converging, and we are seeing a world where, you know, we've got Disney and RTL and other players, big players, studio players, buying up multi-channel networks because they recognize the potential here. It is possibly a golden age for television, possibly a golden age for the shorter form, yet of course feature films are still very much a prominent part of our media landscape. So hopefully the next 45 minutes will clarify some of the issues you have. We're going to hear from our panel. We'll have time for some questions, and I think we'll find out that the keys here are entrepreneurship, innovation, and embracing all the different kinds of platforms. So with that, I want to start by introducing the panel, at least those who are here already. Rob Aff, welcome back. Rob's been a regular for these programs here at Digital Hollywood. Rob is president of Compliance Consulting, a Los Angeles-based media finance and distribution consultancy, which serves a variety of clients, including banks, law firms, producers, distributors, directors, and talent guilds around the world. Rob Aft had headed distribution and sales at a number of independent film companies and recently executive produced Sony's You Got Served, Beat the World. He has served seven terms as a member of the board of directors of the Independent Film and Television Alliance and has many other significant credentials as well. And then also joining him is Bruce David Eisen. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Bruce is CEO and founder of Here Is TV, the web's leading provider of daily human-curated TV show recommendations. Bruce Eisen is also president and founder of Digital Advisors, a digital distribution consulting firm advising a broad range of clients from startups to Fortune 500 companies, including 20th Century Fox, Blockbuster, and Technicolor. Most recently, Bruce Eisen was Vice President Online Content Development and Strategy for Dish Network. We'll introduce joining us a substitute panelist, Philip Goldfein, who is the founder of Hollywood Media Bridge. We'll tell you more about him when he does arrive. But the key ingredient here is that all three of these men work together. In fact, they're on each other's speed dials on the phone, which is what Rob Aft is doing right now.
4 o'clock.
Do you want us to step out of the room? We can do that.
I'm doing a panel right now. I'll talk to you then, Greg.
Okay. Please, come on in and have a seat. Please, join us.
All right.
So what I was going to say was that, please, have a seat. What is the common point for our three panelists is that they all worked at Trimark in the past.
And Trimark sort of morphed into Lionsgate
exactly.
About 10 years ago.
So. Right.
And Bruce was there for a long time running their
legal business affairs.
Legal business affairs, but also then the platform.
There's a platform?
Yeah, the new media platform.
Cinema Now, that
Best Buy bought.
Yeah. Talking to the microphone?
Yeah, and we didn't say, but Bruce Eisen is an attorney, so that's
yes,
critical
yes.
distinction right. as well.
Very critical.
And where I wanted to start with all that, and maybe Bruce start with you, because what it comes down to when we're talking about maximizing revenues on these new distribution platforms and the windows and exclusivity and all the rest of it is the contract. And so my question to you and then to Rob will be about how different things are. I mean, if this is a new world, are these new contracts, or are we seeing the kinds of issues, the kinds of concerns, if I can put it this way, the kinds of clauses that we've always seen?
It depends, is the answer.
That's a lawyer's
answer. There you go. If you're talking about film distribution, it's really very similar to what it was in the past, except now the word internet is dispersed throughout the agreement, and issues pertaining to that, security, SVOD, which weren't there in the past. But at the end of the day, the bottom line, it's still distributing it, and so whether it's SVOD or VOD or home video or EST or TV, each one has its own separate set of issues that need to be thought about and dealt with. But from the producer's perspective, it's how do you maximize the revenues for each of those?
Right. And you have to pay attention to all of them, but there will be common questions, common concerns you should have regardless of the format, regardless of the platform.
Yeah, it's, why are you raping me and taking all the money? And, then it gets into details.
Well, Rob F., what's your view on that? How new is the contracts that we're looking at and talking about?
Well, most of them are fairly similar to the contracts that Bruce and I were doing at Trimark 20-some years ago. And they incorporate the same general terms. What are the rights that are being granted? What's the term of the agreement? How many years does it last? What are the payments going to be? What might be potentially some back end? The back end terms are usually not as well. It depends on the platform. In some cases, they are. In some cases, Netflix just gives you a flat deal. But in other cases, video on demand might pay you per transaction. But it's still understanding how the person you're licensing the rights to is going to generate revenue, how they're going to share those revenues with you, what you need to provide to them. You think, well, I need to provide a good program. I need to provide a good film. But beyond that, they're also going to want your material in a certain format that might cost a significant amount of money to create for them. What are the delivery items? Especially if you're producing something very low budget, then to deliver to Netflix might cost you more than the budget of the material to begin with. So there are all those issues, but in terms of the programming created specifically for the internet, that's you're facing a situation where often the distributor is also the financier of the entire program. So you're getting into ownership issues. Who owns the copyright to that? You're not simply licensing a window. And that's one of the points that's really important that's always been important, it's probably more important now, is when you create something, when you create intellectual property, what rights are you creating? You're creating a theatrical right, a video right, a new media right, a merchandising right, soundtrack, whatever it is. You need to understand what you've created and what the value is and whether or not the person you're working with is able to exploit that, whether or not they're properly compensating you for it. Are they taking all of the rights forever in every media and giving you a huge amount of money? That's the studio model, and that's fine. If you're getting enough money, if you're getting enough money out of it, it is fine. But if they're paying you a very low amount of money and taking everything away from you, you want the opportunity to make some money down the road.
I want to talk about something that Rob mentioned, because you're absolutely right on the delivery stuff. Typically, electronic sell-through is, as between the distributor and the producer, is done on a rev share basis. So the producer will get X percent or money every time the film is sold on an electronic sell-through EST basis.
That's basically the iMovies model.
Yeah, iTunes.
iTunes
yeah.
model.
And quite often on VOD, the same thing is true. So it's on a rev share. Where it becomes relevant is who's paying for those delivery materials. So the distributor wants the producer to deliver the mezzanine files and the metadata and everything that's required at the producer's cost. So you're going to spend a good hunk of money to do that. If it's going to iTunes, that's probably okay because quite a few people use iTunes. You know, if it's going to Bob's VOD service, and no offense to Bob, who's going to find that movie and how are they going to market it and how many sales are there going to be? So the bottom line to it, of course, is you could wind up spending more money to deliver the materials to a distributor than you're going to make from that distributor. Just something to think about.
And something else to think about, Bruce, that I want to sort of pick up from where Rob left off, which is about the rights questions. As an attorney, ask you whether the kinds of rights that are in demand or that are demanded from producers, has that changed in this new media world? I mean, there is an expectation here around global distribution, and in the past, perhaps territorial issues were more parsed than they are today.
Yes. Less so in terms of the territory. Where it comes up more often is in terms of traditional versus online, and particularly in terms of TV. So quite often, we all know the TV networks, many of them or most have an online component. HBO Go is a good example. And so they're going to want, in addition to the traditional television rights, the online rights as well, and that could create issues. Oh, my God, everybody, it is Oscar and Emmy winner Philip Eagle. Oh, please stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up.
There will be no speech, though. Well, actually, you do have to talk, but you have to answer my questions.
Terrible traffic.
Well, that's Los Angeles for you. We just welcome to the room. We just welcome to the room Philip Goldfein. And although you've just had quite a rousing introduction, Philip, I think I should give people the background on you if they're not familiar. So welcome, first of all. Philip Goldfein is founder of Hollywood Media Bridge, a film and television studio based on the Universal Pictures lot. And he has over 60 film credits, 5 television series. He's an Emmy winner and executive producer of the 2014 Oscar-winning documentary The Lady in Number 6, Music Saved My Life. In television, Philip Goldfein's show The Lawman was the highest-rated launch in A&E history when it premiered. And SEAL Team 6, the multi-Emmy-nominated film, was also the highest-rated film when it premiered on National Geographic. Phil's worked with talent as far-ranging as Oscar winner Hilary Swank, Jack Black, Wesley Snipes, Val Kilmer, and Steven Seagal. So welcome indeed. And we've been having a conversation about this world of new media and just how new it all really is. And I pointed out that each of you here, Rob, Bruce, and Philip, all worked at Trimark in the past. And so where I wanted to start with them, and I'll start with you, Phil, to sort of catch up, is just how new this world really is. I mean, you still are very much grounded in film and television to some extent, but new media is a world apart from yours, or do you find that the distinctions are blurring, are kind of dissolving as we speak?
I'd say it's mainly apart, just simply because we're still probably 75% to 80% of our business is with traditional media, so with the studios, with the networks. But we do have a deal with Netflix, who's an extremely important client to us, so we are into that. But again, I mean, for our company, we're probably still 75% just traditional media.
But you watch that number change over time, or has that been a pretty steady figure for you?
No, it's definitely changed. I mean, we were probably 100%, maybe even 5 years ago. Rob, when did we start with Netflix? It was about 2000.
It was a little bit more than 5 years ago.
Okay, so a little more than five years ago.
But
I would say it's changing each year. It gets more and more. I mean, probably last year it was 20%. This year it's already up to 25%. So maybe next year it'll be even more.
Right. And Philip, I also want to be sure that we bring up a point which I hope will come back, which is about the global perspective that you have. And we're talking here about, you know, maximizing revenue on these new media platforms, and global is a key part of all of that. For your business, even in the film producing side of things, again, you're not just producing for the screens down the street, you're producing for screens around the world, China and elsewhere. And that really informs the decisions you make about what you produce and what kinds of movies you make.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we really are primarily a foreign-driven company. So we're going to make movies that are going to appeal to a global audience. The U.S. is maybe 20 to 35%. It's really not 35%. It's closer to 15 to 25%. But the rest of the world is super important to us. So we find ourselves like always saying to the group, okay, is this show going to work around the world? Primarily pan Latin America, pan Europe, pan Asia. China's still a small market for us.
Okay, but you know, when we talk about maximizing revenue, you have to think about that world of screens, whether big or small. Would you suggest to people who are still in the new media side of things, you know, they may have a YouTube platform or deal with a multi-channel network, that they also think about the global potential for whatever they're putting together?
Yeah, I do. I think that YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, I mean, they're all going to be global networks. I mean, YouTube is already a global network, and Netflix is going to be a global network probably by the end of this year. So you've got to be thinking about everything for these guys. So you're not just thinking about the U.S. market. You're thinking about the French market. You're thinking about the German market. You're thinking about the Latin American market always.
And Bruce Eisen, that's going to have an impact on the deals themselves, right? Because there's going to be expectations. I mean, we're saying that in some sense, territoriality matters less than it might have in the past. And yet there still will be deals in France that will have certain expectations around windows and around exclusivity that may actually make it impossible for you to do that deal because of another deal you've done previously or deal that might be looming which would offer more.
Yeah, no, exactly right. So it's a question of balance, right? So if one entity is offering you X amount of dollars for the world, as an example, you weigh that against what can you get out of each territory or, you know, various territories. I'm sure it's something that Phil deals with every day.
Yeah, we do.
But is there a formula? Can I put it this way? I mean,
X plus Y equals 100%.
But would you rather? I mean, given you know your understanding of the situation, would you rather do a lot of different smaller deals, or would you rather see that global deal for?
Well, yeah, you'd rather do one deal that brings in a ton of money. You've got more money coming in, less transactional costs, less things to worry about. But you get the money wherever you can.
Rob Aft, we mentioned that you were on the board for IFTA, there, the Independent Film Television Alliance, and they've got a PDF available, which we will make available to anybody here, that looks at some of these issues, particularly that global perspective.
Right. Yeah, they came out with this last year, and I was really impressed by it. It's called the IFTA Television VOD and Digital Licensing Guide, and it kind of has... I think it's available on their website, which is just ifta-online.org. But it's an amazingly complete document. I was really impressed by it. It answers a lot of the questions that we're not going to have time to answer here. And especially dealing with how these rights or licenses, what they're called. I'm still between OTT and catch-up rights, and that's 3 years ago. I think we even had a panel about what everything's called now, and now it's all different. So you've really got to worry about that, because if you've licensed certain rights with your TV deal, if you've licensed catch-up rights with your TV deal, how is that going to affect your new media deal? How is that going to affect your Netflix deal? Is Netflix going to want exclusivity during a certain period of time? What does exclusivity mean? And how are territories divided? In Europe, are you selling France or are you selling French-speaking Europe? And if someone's buying French-speaking Europe, does that mean they're also taking French-speaking Africa? Which is, I got an inquiry yesterday on Portuguese Africa. Yeah. And it's from somebody that wouldn't be asking me if they weren't getting a significant amount of money per title. Wow. So it's Daro.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Great. Fantastic.
And I just thought, wow, it's okay. So you've got to be concerned about all these things and keeping your windows short. How short can you keep your Netflix window? How short can you keep your new media window when you license to a TV broadcaster? And those are questions that you have to always be asking, and the answers are always changing. And so you often have to rely on the expertise of a qualified international sales agent, or there's even a few domestic people that are really good at working those windows and not stepping on the various rights. And it's gotten more complicated, and it's nearly impossible for individual producers to do it on their own.
Well, but that's what I wanted to ask, Rob, because we did do a panel a couple of years ago on, you know, the whole idea of do it yourself. How good an idea is that, or not such a good idea? When it comes to these kind of deals, I see Phil Goldfein smiling.
Phil, not such a good idea.
Not such a good idea. We'll let you tell us what.
Phil's great at it domestically, but internationally he relies on
other people.
So, as advice for people in this room and listening to the podcast, DIY is not. You might DIY the product, but you're not going to DIY the deal.
I don't think so. I mean, it's impossible to do. There are so many territories, and then you also have to know everybody. Now you also have to be knowing about all the contracts, the stuff that Bruce is talking about. Now you're doing 100 contracts. I mean, who's got time for that? So we always outsource, basically. We partner up with a foreign sales company, so we'll do North America ourselves. And then we'll partner up with a foreign sales company. And we can either partner up with them 50-50, or they could just be a sales agent for us. But there's no... I'm so sorry. But there is no way that we have the time to do it.
Right. And Phil Eisen, that's what lawyers are all about, is making sure that those contracts get read and parsed. And I wonder, for the room, can you give us an idea of particular areas that you focus on? Rob's been talking about windows and trying to keep them as short as possible. Is that the first place to look?
No, the first place is the compensation. That's the first place to look.
But even that's a complicated answer because
exactly.
but even the answer to that isn't going to be clear either, right? Because the shape of the compensation is going to vary depending on the deal.
Yes, you can't look at any one part. It's the whole deal as a whole, and I think to your point, what are the impacts on other deals, which may be as obvious as, okay, this deal wants the same rights as this other deal got. Okay, we know we can't do that. But it may even be less obvious. For instance, they may want a holdback that we can't give because of a conflicting deal. So it's not that they're getting the rights. You know, Netflix, In Demand, for instance, might say, okay, we want a 60-day holdback. So after the film comes off of our system, you can't put it anywhere for 60 days, making it up. In and of itself, fine, no problem, except when you go to do the Netflix deal and they want it 30 days after.
Yeah,
everything is negotiable. You know, how well you will do it just depends on your negotiating power.
Right.
Well, if you've got a Steven Spielberg film, you may do okay. Well, if not, it's just, you know, it's all negotiable.
What about that, Rob? I mean, your experience at IFTA, we should also tell people that you do a lot of work for WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and there's some great work that you've done on copyright-related issues and rights issues. We want to get into some of the rights that could sort of maximize your revenue down line, you know, from the shorter form to the longer form. But to the point about leverage in negotiations, Bruce was saying it all depends on who you are. But is there room for negotiation around some of those kinds of key points? How optimistic should people be that they could get what they're looking for?
What I've noticed is because you've got corporations deal, when you're going to Netflix, most people are not going to have a lot of leverage negotiating with Netflix. If you're a YouTube partner, you have no leverage whatsoever. You accept their deal. Recently, YouTube said, well, if you're a YouTube partner and we're giving you the VOD advertising monies, now you also have to be part of our subscription service. And it's impossible to go back and renegotiate, from my understanding. So you can't, as an individual producer, say, oh, no, I'm only going to be on your demand service and not on your subscription service. That won't work. And you can't negotiate your ad rates. You can't negotiate any of those things with YouTube. Netflix, you can negotiate a little bit more. One of the things that notoriously you can't negotiate with Netflix is their payment schedule.
Yeah, payment terms.
And they pay over a certain period of time, and they won't change that.
It is what it is.
And so it does. There are lots of negotiating points, but the most important thing is to try to talk to people who've done this before and get their read on things. Just don't waste your time trying to negotiate with YouTube over whether or not it's going to go on subscription. It's not. Or what is Netflix paying for certain types of things? Well, if they're offering you half of that, then you know that you might have some negotiating room. So they usually know everything, and you know nothing. So the more you know, the better you can negotiate the terms, and the more you'll be, you know, the less you'll be frustrated by things that you can't negotiate.
And to the extent that you can, you need to be thinking ahead, because it's not just the deal on the table, but if you're trying to build a career, you've got to be thinking about where you're going to be in a certain period of time. And one of the things you pointed out to me was there's a potential here for short form to include IP that you may want to then spin out into other types of product. Talk about that and why thinking ahead in that area is really critical.
Well, when you create original IP,
intellectual property.
You're creating characters, storylines. Obviously, the examples are all the superhero things, you know, the Batman, Superman, Spider-Man kinds of things, where they existed. They've existed on multiple platforms, on television shows, on comic books, but also graphic novels, and obviously films, and so. You don't know right now if what you're creating is going to become a global brand like Star Wars, which obviously Fox didn't know was going to be Star Wars, or otherwise they would have kept all of the sequel merchandising, whatever rights. And so you need to understand what rights you're giving up in a contract. And obviously you'd rather not give up sequel, remake, other format rights. You'd like to give up simply the distribution right in that medium for a specific period of time for a specific amount of money and nothing else. People might want things like right of first negotiation if there is a sequel or a remake or something. But the format, the characters, the storylines, those are potentially hugely valuable in feature films, television programs, books, whatever media they create in the future.
Right, and Philip Goldfein, I said at the opening that in a way this is about mentality. There's a mentality to think like a studio, and then there's a mentality to kind of think like a YouTube star. And in a sense, those are converging along with the various platforms too. And I wonder whether the approach that Rob was just describing is an approach you must recognize as very familiar to you, thinking about the franchise really, not just the individual product.
And yeah, sure. We do. We have a weekly staff meeting, and every staff meeting we talk about, you know, the fact that everything we do should have that franchise ability, potential, but it doesn't work that way. Just because the way that the film business is now, in particular, very, 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 very tough out there. So all of our numbers have gone down. So where we used to, for example, sell a movie, let's just say for a territory, for $1 million, today it could be $300,000 or $200,000. So we find ourselves having to be opportunistic. We'll pick up a movie, we'll look at it, and as long as we can do somewhere between 30 and 100%, we're going to pick it up. So it doesn't always, I mean, we'd love to say, yes, oh, great, I mean, let's do something, let's turn this into Superman or Star Wars, but it doesn't work that way. I mean, basically, we have to be opportunistic to live to fight for another
day. But you do own some valuable franchise properties, or you own some franchise properties.
That's true. We own Green Acres, which we're developing as a Broadway musical. Tickets will be on sale in September 2016. Let's see. We own Art of War with Sony. We own Christmas Story with Warner Brothers. So he's right. I mean, again, he's absolutely right. We try to make sure that we're doing something that's franchisable, but it doesn't always work.
Right, and it's obviously a different level, but I think that's an approach that makes sense for everybody, whether you're on the studio lot or whether you're at home. I
mean, absolutely.
It's a worldview, and that's what I wanted to kind of explore with you. And Bruce Eisen, what about this issue where you said that the money is the most important thing. That's the place to look at first. but if the dollars are going down in that direction, that changes things, doesn't it? I mean, you have to start thinking about getting other deals later on. I mean, I just wonder how that has changed the negotiations. It's made them tougher, I'm sure. Just talk about that.
Well, it's. I mean, the truth is, it's less of a legal issue, more of a business issue, right? So, if there's less dollars, it means you've got to produce content for less.
Got to make more too.
Volume. Yeah, it's the issues don't change. You're just fighting over less money, but at the end of the day, you're just fighting over money.
Well, and Doug Blake, who was going to be on this panel, his production in Louisiana got moved up by a week, which is why he wasn't here. But it's a fairly low budget production for a an online platform. It's
a multi-channel network, an MCN.
Yeah. And it's a known company, very low budget, much lower than he said he would ever have considered working with in the past, but it's a fairly short shoot, and he's getting paid. He knows he's going to get paid. He knows how long the shoot's going to last. It's a decent...
It's a work for hire. He's doing services.
Producing as work for hire, and it's... So that's a different world, but the amount of money he has to work with on a per-episode basis is... nothing. And Buddy shooting in New Orleans are getting some benefits out of Louisiana, and they're able to do it. So you can make viable programming at these very low budgets, and whether or not there's enough revenue that really makes it make sense for everybody involved, I don't know, but there's always the possibility that something like that's going to jump to network television or is going to turn into something bigger.
Right, and to the point that Philip Goldfein was making about you just have to produce more, you have to make more content, the multi-channel networks, I've heard them called multi-clip networks, are really collections of short form, and it's an opportunity to do just that, to make as much as you possibly can and get it out there. And that's a formula for success for a lot of people on YouTube.
Right, and back when we were working at Trimark, it was often our formula for success. We'd make as much as possible, throw it up against the wall, and occasionally we'd get a leprechaun out of it, which would be a huge hit for Trimark back in the day, and still plays.
It would still be a big hit.
That's right, and still generates revenue. Starring Jennifer Aniston, by the way, and so you the more you make, the more potential you're going to have to get one of these things as a hit, but also. You're working with new, interesting talent, which is one of the things I like the most about it. And I don't necessarily understand why certain things on these MCNs are entertaining for people, but I don't like watching things where people get hurt, and that seems to be a large part of the programming. But the opportunity to find new talent anywhere in the world. I work a lot in developing countries, and I think it's just extremely exciting that I can turn on YouTube and see a film made in Kenya or see a short form music program out of Sri Lanka, and I don't know if one of those things is going to break, but the opportunity for them to break is much higher than it used to be.
Yeah, and Bruce Eisen, so you're the founder and CEO of this Here Is TV, provider of human curated TV show recommendations. You are looking at that kind of material for as a source for programming?
No, I don't care about that stuff at all. I think it's boring. This is
had me going there for a second.
No, this enterprise is strictly professionally produced television content that's on broadcast cable networks and the long-form originals done on Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, Crackle, AOL, etc.
Okay.
But so it's not short-form MCN content.
Okay, so there is still a wall there then. You're not going to...
Well, I wouldn't say that there's a wall. I mean, I don't think anybody can do everything, right? So this is what we do.
And ultimately, despite what I've been reading in the catalog here about every other panel being about new media, and I guess it is digital Hollywood, but I don't know what digital means. Everything's digital. But the Leslie Moonves over at CBS still says that it's great, all of the international and all of the, you know, the movies he's making. Where he makes his money is from 8 o'clock to 11 p.m. in the United States, primetime network television on CBS. That's where the bulk of the money is. And sports. but it's just, it's not in all of these new media things, but that's the future. And so everybody's in it and everybody's excited about it. But, like, you know, Bruce's recommendations are for what most people watch. It's stuff that we're all likely to encounter, whereas a lot of this other material is out there to discover, and it's fun and exciting. But if you're planning on making a lot of money in the industry, make primetime network sitcoms.
Well, I want to pick up on that, because maybe that's the perspective we need, and I'll ask a final question, and we'll give an opportunity for people in the room to ask the panel questions, which is, you know, as we've devoted some time to this issue, as you say, Rob F., at Digital Hollywood, they've been talking a lot about new media platforms and the potential there, and I was proposing that there's a merger going on here, there's a kind of dissolving of distinctions. But are you saying, Rob, that your attention as a producer should still be on the traditional forms?
You should do what you enjoy and what you're good at, because most producers do not make a living producing anything. So, you know, it's very hard out there. It's the exception.
I hate when he says that.
The exception here. Most of my friends who call themselves producers have other jobs, and they need to. It's making one thing every couple of years where someone might let you make $50,000 on it is not going to pay the rent.
I happen to think that being a producer is a great job.
Thank you, Bruce.
For somebody who does not need to work for a living.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, wait a minute. Now I'm going to give Philip Goldfein, our Oscar-winning producer.
And Emmy. Don't forget
Emmy,
the Emmy.
And Emmy.
And the swimming.
Let's talk about the swimming.
Triathlete.
The last
not,
word.
Not just
show
swimming.
Us your abs.
Triathlete.
Yes. But Stand up.
Okay. I want to give you the last word on that. I mean, you make 10 to 15 feature films a year.
Yeah, we're actually starting our sixth movie a week from Monday for 2015 so far. But again, I don't really listen to, I mean, I listen to Rob a lot and Bruce, but I don't let the numbers or the negativity get me. I just look at the deal and say, okay, yeah, we're going to do that. For instance, we're extremely opportunistic. A deal came to us not even a week ago where a group of producers were shooting a movie, and the bank had come to us and said, can you help these guys? They're in trouble. So we've now stepped in. We've taken over the movie. We've given them the money that they need to finish the movie, and now we'll do it. So we'll finish it, and then we'll sell it. So there's all these different opportunities out there, and that's why I think being a producer is a great job, as long as you remain focused and just know what your goal is. Our goal is very clear. It's to make 10 to 15 movies a year that are all profitable before we spend a dime, and then move on. And our ultimate goal is to maybe make 30 of these a year, just simply because people aren't doing it. And like Rob had pointed out, I mean, I model my company after New Line, where I came from, in Trimark. It's really a volume business at a certain budget level, and because there's plenty of distribution outlets for us. So we just try to maximize it as best we possibly can.
All right. Well, I want to thank Rob Aft, Compliance Consulting, Philip Goldfein, Hollywood Media Bridge, and Bruce David Eisen of Here Is TV for your contributions to the panel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.